I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds, episode number 202. And John, now that we're over the 200 hump, I got to let you know I'm just going to phone it in.
Yeah, I figure for the next 100 episodes, we could totally do that, and then we'll catch like our second win around episode 300, and it should be good. That is Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, and a podcast dude, also a Hugo nominee for the SF Signal podcast. You can check out his website, atfmb.com, and follow him on Twitter, at atfmb. My name is John Anilio. I am a songwriter and a composer. You can check out my music over at johnanilio.com, and follow me on Twitter, at johnanilio. And our guest today is Sylvia Itso Hunter. She is the author of The Midnight Queen, which is a story of magic, true love, and scholarship. She lives in Toronto, Ontario. Her website is Sylvia Itso, that's I-Z-Z-O. SylviaItsoHunter.ca. I told you, she's Canadian. She has a .ca. And her Twitter handle is at Syl, S-Y-L, at Syl Writes Things. Sylvia, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
All right. So far, our connection is pretty good for a Canadian, because a lot of times our Canadian calls tend to be like there's like a delay or something weird. So you're in like the good part of Canada.
Sylvia, don't let him give you crap, because Paul Kemp is on the border and he's on our side and we've had troubles with his connection. So don't let him try to tell you it's Canada.
Yeah, it tends to be that the borderline of Canada and the U.S. and the Midwest there. That seems to be the dead zone.
So, John, did you send Sylvia an email inviting her to Functional Nerds before you had ever spoken with her?
Yes, this is the first time I'm speaking
with her. Okay, so just so you understand, under the new Canadian Spam Act, you could be liable and she could sue you for millions of dollars for an unsolicited email.
But you know what? It was solicited because... We actually booked this through her publicist, Nita.
That doesn't matter.
Okay.
Well, the new Canadian email laws are crazy. I can't actually email anything up there anymore, so it's fun.
I think Nita actually sent the email on to me. I'm not sure that you emailed me directly before I had agreed to do the podcast, so I think you're okay.
Yes. I believe the email was, you know, an introductory email between the two of us. I think Nita emailed both of us.
Yes.
I've got a giant sign at work now that says, do not send emails to Canada. Because I'm a digital marketing specialist, Sylvia, so part of my job is to do email marketing. And even though we have business relationships, we have customers who have bought our products and use our stuff, I'm not allowed to email them because everybody's freaking out thinking we're going to get sued for millions of dollars. And that's it. And no one cares. Fine.
Well, you know, Sylvia, you know, I wanted, you know, your book's getting a lot of good press. And I actually know he'd be your agent, I guess. It's Joshua is your agent, correct? Joshua Gomez is.
Actually, Eddie Schneider is my agent, but they hang,
right. So I know a lot of those folks from, because I'm in New Jersey, so, and we talked to a couple different people, and your book's getting a lot of good press already, and, you know, maybe you could just tell our listeners a little bit about the book and what they can expect if they want to check it out and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, well, it's kind of magic, mystery, and mayhem in an alternate Europe where Henry V didn't die of dysentery and Christianity never really took off. So it's all, you know, Romano-Celtic polytheism is a thing. Magic is out there. Everybody uses it. Everybody knows about it. I've seen a lot of comparisons to Harry Potter, which is a little bit, you know, I don't think very accurate, but it is like Harry Potter, I'll tell you, in that it has magic in it, and it has an owl.
Wow. That's, you're just totally that's ripping off it. Harry Potter. That's
totally, totally. I'm totally ripping it off, yes. So there's a political plot, there's a romance plot, there's, I like to think, a bit of humor in there somewhere, and I had a really great time writing it, and I hope people will enjoy reading it.
Yeah, we Patrick and I are fortunate enough between this podcast, and Patrick does some stuff for SF Signal, and we get sent a lot of books, both ebooks and physical copies of books. And so I will tell you, it's a wonderful dilemma to have so many books that you can't read them all.
Yeah.
And when I was preparing for our podcast today, I'm like, oh, I have to read this one now. This is right up, because there's music, which we're going to get to later on in the main part of the show, because I'm a musician, so there's a lot of cool stuff. And I always like that sort of in terms of magic systems and religions and things like that, and how, you know, an alternate, a little bit, it sounds a little bit alternate history, I guess you can describe it as that too. So it's all like a lot of the boxes that I like in my reading, especially my fantasy reading, are ticked with this one. So I think this is going to be next on my list once I'm done with the current book I'm working on. So it sounds great. So I'm really looking forward to reading it. So when was it published? When is the actual published date on this one?
It's actually coming out on September 2nd.
Oh, so it's a little early, so yeah, okay, good.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully people will listen to this and pre-order it and get it ready to go. So that's great. I'm very much looking forward to this. Okay, Patrick, do you have any questions before we move on into picks then?
No, not if we don't want to talk about the email laws in Canada.
Well, we'll just Canada bash for another 7 to 10 minutes, and then we'll...
It's cool. I'm used to it.
Yeah. It's the most comprehensive and complicated spam law ever. Seriously. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what people outside of Canada are going to do. Oh, that's right. They don't care. Just they don't care.
Oh,
no, no. They don't care about our Canned Spam Act either. That's the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, let's move on to our picks of the week, John.
Let's do that. All right. Here's our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Sylvia, why don't you go first with your pick this week?
Okay, I actually have two because I couldn't decide. And the first one is a thing that already exists, and the other one is one that doesn't exist yet. So, but they have a theme. One of my strange tastes in reading is Bletchley Park and code breaking, Enigma machines, all of that kind of stuff. And so the first thing that I am really excited about right now is an ITV series, two series, unfortunately, it wasn't renewed for a third, called The Bletchley Circle, which is about a group of women who worked at Bletchley Park as code breakers or ancillary staff during the war. And now it's the 50s, and they have their normal lives, and they get together and solve mysteries because they can't not. And it's very difficult for them because they're women and it's the 50s and they are not supposed to do that. And also the Official Secrets Act is still preventing them from telling anyone what they actually did in the war. So relatedly, my second pick is the movie about Alan Turing, The Imitation Game, which is coming out in the fall. It's, don't think it's the world premiere, but I think the North American premiere is going to be at the Toronto International Film Festival, and it's got Benedict Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley in it. So, and it's basically, it's about Turing's work at Bletchley in the war, but it also goes on to the tragic end of his life, and I'm really looking forward to seeing that because I think Cumberbatch is a fantastic actor, and because I am really a fan of Alan Turing, and I think that this movie, from what I've heard and seen so far, is going to really be a tribute to him.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that too, because I remember seeing something about it a few months back that Benedict Cumberbatch was cast, and you know my wife and I are working through Sherlock on Netflix right now, and we both become pretty big fans of him, and yeah, Alan Turing's story is so. It's so compelling and you know, and obviously not to get into all that because that's a whole podcast discussing Alan Turing, but it's movie material. I mean, there's really, I mean, he led such a brilliant and tortured kind of life. So I'm really curious to see that one too. So very cool. So when is that movie getting released now?
I am not sure. I think the general release may be October or November.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, my question for both of you is, if you're fans of Benedict, did J.J. Trek 2, This Is Not the Wrath of Khan, tarnish his image in your view whatsoever?
I, Well, you can go first, Sylvie. Why don't you answer that question?
I thought he was very good in it, but I really, you know, I had some issues with the film. I did.
Patrick, I'll answer in that I actually watched that movie before I started watching Sherlock. So I thought he was fine. I didn't know his work beforehand, so he was just an actor, and I thought he was fine. And you know, I watched that Star Trek movie. I'm not super into Star Trek. So if you're really into Star Trek, I know everyone who's really into Star Trek is not into that movie. But I just looked at it. You know, I watched it on Netflix by myself one night, and it was a perfectly watchable space battle movie with, you know. So it was fine. But if you're going into it with all of the expectations that you have of what a Star Trek piece of entertainment is, I could totally see why, as a Star Trek fan, that would not, like, do much for you. But for what I watched it for, it was totally fine and watchable. So, you know, it's all about expectations, really, is what it comes down to. All right, Patrick, what's your pick this week, then?
My pick this week is the Dave Gibbons collection of Doctor Who strips from Doctor Who magazine.
Ooh,
and awesome. Dave Gibbons was a...
Watchmen, right?
Very acclaimed, very acclaimed guy. And he essentially was the primary artist on this from Doctor Who magazine number 1 all the way through 69. And he did the entire reign of the Fourth Doctor, Tom Baker. Mm-hmm. So it covers the entire Tom Baker era and then finishes with the Peter Davison era. It has one Fifth Doctor story. And it's massive. It is this gigantic, gigantic book. And they can see it on the video right now. It's out from IDW. And the art is great. The stories are great. It's very much like a classic episode of Doctor Who in that, you know, it's kind of short and it always ends on a cliffhanger. And the idea was, you know, to get you to turn the page or get the next issue. So it's a very cool collection. And I was down in Colorado Springs at a Barnes & Noble, and they had a great sci-fi and fantasy section. Yeah. So I was really impressed because I saw a lot of stuff from our friends, John. Lafferty's books were in there. Chuck Wendig's books were in there. I mean, it was really, really cool. And then I started going through the graphic novels, and I came across this one. So I picked it up. It's... it's kind of a hefty price. It was $30, but like I said, it is massive. There are
whenever you have a big book with art, it's always going to be around then, and well
it's
worth
400 pages.
Yeah, I mean, you're getting a lot of bang for your buck there, I think.
Yeah.
So cool, very good. I'll have to check that out. My pick this week is an album. I'm kind of like been listening to stuff that I don't know if you're gonna if you're a fan of this particular album, but I've been on this sort of classic rock kick, but not sort of the usual suspects. So I've been listening to bands like Humble Pie and Free and The Faces and Beck Bogart and all these sort of like, I guess if you look back on the history of classic rock, sort of like second tier kind of bands, you know, bands that maybe had a hit or two, but stuff that I'm not all that familiar with their work. And so the album that I'm going to pick is by the band Free. And Free had a big hit with All Right Now. And if you ever listen to classic rock radio, you've heard All Right Now a zillion times. So I'm picking the album that's on, which is called Fire and Water. And I never heard any other song on that album before. And it's great. To give you the main points of it, Paul Rodgers was the singer in Free. So Paul Rodgers went on to then be in Bad Company. So if you know all the Bad Company songs, like Can't Get Enough of Your Love and everything, he's singing that, and he's singing All Right Now. And then he recently, a couple years ago, toured with Queen a few times and was sort of the singer in Queen for a couple albums, which was kind of an odd choice because he doesn't really sound anything like Freddie Mercury. He has a much more sort of soulful, bluesy voice rather than like kind of an operatic Freddie Mercury type of voice. But I love his voice, and I love the sound of this record, and all these records I've been listening to them on Spotify. Albums were just recorded so much different, and I think music was just so much different back then, and I don't mean to be an old dinosaur rocker guy, because I love a lot of new music too, but you could tell that this was a band that probably played a ton of gigs, rehearsed this stuff for, you know, months, if not years, went into the studio, probably did most of it live. And it's just very simple meat and potatoes, guitar, bass, drums, and everything sounds so full and so big and so warm. And it's just a great rock album. And I think albums were another reason why I like a lot of albums from that time is because they're short compared to today's albums. They're all like maybe 8 songs, you know, maybe 40 minutes, which I think is sort of the perfect length for an album. I think, you know, once we got to CDs, albums all had 14 songs on it. And I kind of feel like that's too much because I always feel like there's like 3 or 4 filler songs. So I'd always much rather hear an 8 to 10 song album of all awesome songs. And so that's that. So yeah, it's called, the band is Free and the album I'm picking is called Fire and Water. So that's my pick.
I said, hey, what's your name?
Yeah,
come on, John.
It's great. No, I love it. Anyway, okay, so getting on to it. So, Cecilia, we talked a little bit about your book that's coming. And so is this your debut book, Sylvia, or do you have any
other? Yes, it is.
Oh, cool. Yeah, congratulations.
This is it.
Okay, awesome. Well, so the first thing that I want to ask you is, you know, when I was doing a little bit of research, is something that comes up is Regency, England. So I'm not all that familiar with what Regency England means. So maybe you can explain to our listeners and to me what Regency England would imply.
Okay, so the first thing, Regency England in this context is actually two things. The Regency in England was a period in sort of roughly the end of the, broadly speaking, from the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century. It's kind of like the Napoleonic War era, the War of 1812, which was like a little, you know, roadshow of the War of 1812. Jane Austen is probably the best known writer from that era that's still read a lot today. If you've ever read Patrick O'Brien, the Aubrey and Maturin books, those are also that period.
Okay.
So that's kind of what we're talking about. The reason it was called the Regency was that there was a prince regent who was kind of in charge of England at the time. So that's where it gets its name.
Joffrey?
And pardon me?
It wasn't Joffrey.
Fortunately not.
Okay.
The reason for the regent was that King George III he went mad. I think that historians now think that he had porphyria, which is some kind of chemical imbalance, which I used to know, I used to understand, but no longer do. So the setting of my book is not actually Regency in that there isn't a regent. There's a king on the throne. He's a fictional king. He's descended from he's in the line of the Tudors, who, of course, were no longer on the throne and had not been on the throne for quite a long time by the actual Regency period in actual England. But a lot of the sort of world-building details, fashions and carriages and technology to some extent, although it's less because of the presence of magic, there's less technological advancement than there was in the real Regency period. That's sort of, a lot of that is modeled on this period. So it's kind of aesthetically Regency, but not actually Regency. Mm-hmm. So in book marketing, Regency is also sort of a marketing category. So Georgette Heyer and people who set romance novels, mainly sometimes mysteries. There was a P.D. James book a couple years ago called Death Comes to Pemberley, which was a murder mystery starring Elizabeth and Darcy from Pride and Prejudice. Mm. So it's also a marketing category, and I think it's mostly in that sense that this book is a Regency book because it's not actually set in Regency England. And that was a really long answer.
No, that's what I wanted to hear because I was so it's really because by definition a regent is someone who is sort of leading the kingdom while. There, I think a lot of times in terms of like the many fantasy novels I've read over the years, it's when like the king is like sort of a boy king, so they have like the regent taking care of it or something like that.
Yeah, so it's incapacity. basically. Yes. Either from being very young or from being very old and, you know, mm-hmm.
right.
Alzheimer's, whatever.
Yes, yeah. So that leads kind of to the next question that I had, which was, and you touched on a little bit in the beginning, which is you sort of changed what the way that religion would have been in that time, because I suppose at that time it would have been, Christianity would have really started taking hold of a lot of Europe by then. So what is sort of the key difference? And then maybe they may be totally unrelated, because sometimes in fantasy, like, there's a religion or quasi-religion or mythology that's sort of tied up with the magic system. And I know your books have magic, and I don't know if the magic is completely separate from the religion. Tell us how this period, even though it's sort of not Regency England, but sort of technology-wise, as you said it is, how the religion in your book is handled differently than what it would have been during that time period.
Okay, so what happened to me was that as I got the world building underway, and it became clear that this was a world where magic is not furtive, it's not hidden, it's not occult in any way. It's out there in the open, people practice it. You can study it at university, as Gray does. And I sort of tried to square that, like I tried to think how the established church, the Church of England, would deal with that, and I just couldn't make it work. Mm. And so then I was thinking about a book I read years ago by a called Constantine's Sword, which is about the history, well, the Catholic mainly, and Judaism. And the thought I had was, well, what if Constantine hadn't had his famous battlefield conversion to Christianity? What if instead he just hadn't? And what if the Roman Empire spread across Europe and conquered all the barbarians and so on, but that didn't lead to the spread of Christianity throughout Europe? And what I sort of got out of that, and, you know, I'm making a lot of stuff up here, right? Like, I'm a fantasy author, what can I say? Mm-hmm. What I kind of got out of that was this idea of the Roman Empire spreading its religious practices, but not in a prescriptive way. Like, we'll leave your religious practices alone. You know, we don't care what gods you believe in, provided you pay your taxes and, you know, don't, like, disturb the Pax Romana. You can do what you want. So now, like, all of these centuries later, what we have is sort of this strange polytheistic patchwork of lots of gods, lots of live and let live, lots of temples all over the place that people, you know, and this affects it has a lot of knock-on effects. And one of them is that prayer is kind of there's this expression in Latin, do ut des, which means I give so that you may give in return. So it's prayer is quite transactional, actually, which is a strange idea for us. The magic is, there's a line in a book that I made up that some of the characters read. The magic is the god's gift and their curse. So there's an understanding sort of that this is not a world where you see, like, the gods diving in and interfering directly, talking to people. In that sense, the religion in this book is very much like religion is in Jane Austen. People sort of, it's there. It permeates everything, but people don't talk about it a lot. Mm. And there's no sense that anyone's getting messages from on high or, you know, burning bushes or talking or anything like that. But the idea is that magic comes from the gods, just like everything else does. But these gods are not, they're not omniscient necessarily, they're not omnipotent, and they're definitely not, you know, all good. They're capricious, they're very human in some ways. They're, you know, the Greek and Roman gods, and they do stuff that they want to do. Mm. And so there's not this, there's certainly a concept of fate, of, you know, the fates having control, some control over your life, but there's not the idea that there's a benevolent providence that's going to make sure it all works out all right. That isn't there. So the magic is, it's part of the world. The sense is that it was created at the same time as other parts of the world, like the rocks and the trees and the people and the animals. And it's a natural thing. So, and that's how, kind of how I reconciled the idea of there being religion and there also being magic and that they wouldn't conflict with each other.
Cool. That sounds great. And, you know, I know that you, I want to talk a little bit about music now. And on your website, you talk about, there's a couple of interesting bits about the music and how it's used in the book and mm-hmm. how they're, so I guess it's sort of the same time period musically. I didn't sync up my, and it's been 20 years since I've taken a music history class. So my, my music history is a little rusty. One of the characters is playing some keyboard pieces, and they're playing these dances, a pavon and a boré, and this would have been something like Bach or Telemann or Scarlatti. So we're talking about like Baroque period of music. Does that sort of sync up with this time period, or?
It does a little bit. There are examples of those kinds of dances. The best known ones are from the Baroque period. Jean-Baptiste Lully, François Couperin, a bunch of French composers of the same sort of period also wrote dance suites like that. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them are actually based on folk tunes, mm-hmm. Traditional melodies. So I think some of them go back quite far. Mm-hmm. And some of the dances that go with them also go back quite far. They're called in French contredanse, mm-hmm. Which I think is because you dance them opposite each other or something. they're like a strip the willow or a reel. You dance them in two lines and you go mm-hmm. up and down the dance. But in English, that turned into country dances, and I think that's. It doesn't mean that they were danced in the country necessarily, but I think that might have been adopted. I'm making this etymology totally up. I'm sorry. because the etymology might have kind of fit, even though that's not where the word comes from at all. It is from the French contredanse. So I'm not exactly sure what the contemporary art music of this era would be like. I feel like there's maybe a bit of maybe not Mozartian, because he was very innovative, but sort of maybe the younger generation of Bachs.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. One of the lines that I came across when you're talking about the character playing these kind of dances is that it would have been something like that or an improvisation. Mm-hmm. And that struck me, because I think most people, when they think of classical music and a lot of today's how classical music is often performed today, most people just view it as like, oh, it's musicians and they have their music and they just mm-hmm. read to the music. And it's not like jazz where it's improvised. It's all,
yeah.
And what I think many people don't realize is that at the time, what we consider classical music now from this time period, there was quite a strong element of improvisation.
Absolutely, yeah.
To that music. And I know a lot of the sort of Baroque era stuff, like with these dances, like you were talking about, I know a lot of it was written in figured bass, mm-hmm. which for people who maybe don't know, a figured bass is just sort of like a shorthand. It's sort of the equivalent of what like a jazz chord chart would be. Mm-hmm. Keyboardists would sit at their harpsichord or clavichord or whatever, forte piano, whatever was around at the time, lots of different variations of that, and would sort of improvise on that chord structure or improvise around that melody. And as Sylvie was saying, that a lot of them were sort of folk melodies, and classical composers take folk melodies all the time. They take them all the time.
They stole them all over the place.
Yeah, but I think it was sort of just like that was just part of the art too. That well, people like this melody, so I'm going to take it and mm-hmm. I'm gonna score it. I'm gonna orchestrate it for this sort of setting, and I'm gonna put it in this. And it's a lot of like theme and variations and things like that. But I did enjoy how you did bring up that. No, these musicians improvise. I have a cousin who's a jazz bass player, and he's convinced that, you know, all of that stuff written like in that era, that, you know, they just didn't know how to notate swing eighth notes, that all the eighth notes were actually swung, and they were just like really grooving and digging and swinging and Beethoven really. And I'm like, well, I don't know about that. but you don't know. The thing is, we don't know. And like, I know in when you have a concerto, for instance, again, nowadays, most of the time when there's like sort of the featured solo, say, let's say it's a violin concerto and the violin, there's a part where the orchestra doesn't really play much and the violin just really goes nuts with the cadenza.
Yeah.
Those were mostly improvised, I know, at the time. You know, the composer would write the whole thing and then just basically say like, and the violinist goes nuts here and does all sorts of cool stuff and go crazy, everybody.
And everybody else has 36 bars of rest.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, so whereas nowadays, I think, you know, it's sort of the classic sort of cadenzas or that were then notated, and then I think nowadays most of the time that stuff is written out too. So it's interesting. I was really appreciative that you brought that to light. That's like, oh no, they really did improvise this stuff. But before, you know, we're getting near, we could do a whole episode on music with you, and hopefully we'll have you back in the future and we could talk more about
fun,
it.
Yeah.
But I would love to hear about your musical background, because I know that you sing in a couple of choirs, and so how did you? What's your music background, and what are you doing currently with music?
My musical background is that when I was a toddler, my father used to keep me out of trouble by teaching me to sing opera from records. I never got over that.
That cliche old story of
I know, it happens all the time,
opera,
right?
Yeah.
I started singing in my first choir when I was 9. Mm-hmm. And I have basically been singing in choirs ever since. So that's 31 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I am currently singing in two groups. One is the Orpheus Choir of Toronto, whose tagline is expect something different. So we do a wide variety of stuff, a lot of it, you know, contemporary classical music. We do a lot of premieres. We did the Dvorak Requiem last year, which hadn't been performed in Canada since 1964, I think. That was amazing. And I also sing in a Jewish women's choir here in Toronto called Kol Rina. It's a nice balance. Because you know, the one is very demanding and the other one is a little bit less demanding musically. But it's this really warm, tight-knit group that just gets together because we love to sing so much.
What type of music does the second choir that you mentioned sing?
A lot of different stuff. We do, you know, some Yiddish music, Yiddish folk songs, and some Israeli songs.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we do like arrangements of songs from musicals, movies, that kind of stuff. So, mm-hmm. And we do a lot of sort of rearranging SATB music for SAA. So that's always entertaining.
And I'll be music teachery to our listeners right now. So SATB, which is, that means, no, that's okay. I love getting all teachery. So that's soprano, alto, tenor, bass. Those are the four voice types. So soprano and alto are obviously the female voices, and tenor and bass are the male voices. So, and then SAA or SSA or SAA?
Two of each, yeah.
Okay. So yeah, so that's just basically you're just arranging it for women to sing, so sopranos or kids.
Yeah. I also learned to play the piano and the clarinet and mm-hmm. the treble recorder when I was younger, but I, alas, am mostly not doing those things anymore.
Yeah, we got to keep up on those. My father-in-law is he's an insurance salesman, but he played in orchestras. He still plays in orchestras now, and he's a clarinetist, and that man still gets up early and is hammering away at his chromatic scales every morning while he's doing it, and he's in his 60s, so he still keeps
That's
up
awesome.
With it. It's great, yeah. All right, so before we get going here, let's let people know a little bit. Again, once again, the book is The Midnight Queen and is out in the first week of September, and so go and check that out. Pre-order now. I'm sure you can pre-order it if you go to various places
and
do that. And that is out through, is it Ace Rock, or do you just say Ace at this point?
I don't know. I think just Ace, but...
Yeah.
Anyway,
you can find it. I'm sure by the time people hear this, you're going to start seeing reviews and other interviews and things like that about this book. So go and put this in your queue. And so Sylvia's website is Sylvia Izzo Hunter. So it's IZZO.ca. Patrick, do you need to do 5 more minutes on the Canada spam laws now? Or... And her Twitter handle is at Syl, S-Y-L, writes things. So at Syl, writes things. Anything? So do you have any convention appearances coming up? Anything else you want to let our listeners know about?
If you're in Toronto, if you're in the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area, I am having a book launch on September 7th in the afternoon. It's a Sunday afternoon. I don't know where it's going to be yet, though, but it'll be on the website. So come and check it out. And it'll be on Twitter. Not coming to any appearances, any conventions that I know of, but again, they'll be on the website if there are going to be any.
Awesome. Very good. Okay. For me this week, you can just check out the music that I'm working on. It's over at johnanilio.com. You can follow me on Twitter at johnanilio and Facebook and all that kind of stuff too. Patrick, what do you have going on this week?
SF Signal, we did the Amazon versus Hachette, and we did a massive epic fantasy with Tad Williams, Kate Elliott, Laura Resnick, and Felix Gilman. Got stuff over at Kirkus, but unfortunately we don't have any time, so go check that out.
All right, everybody. Okay, everybody, have a great week, and we will see you next time.
Thanks, Mo.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
Still here? It's over. Go home. Go.